You know, every once in a while, I'm in New York all by myself for one night, and I, you know, I always will just go and buy a last-minute ticket to a Broadway show. And I almost always make really bad decisions under those circumstances. I don't know why. I feel like, well, I'm by myself. I can go see anything. Single seat, easy to get. So there was some night in 08, I guess, 09 maybe, when I was in Broadway, I was doing that, and I didn't go see In the Heights. I can barely even describe the play I went to see instead. It made no impression on me whatsoever. So it looms in my mind as a really terrible decision. I'll never be able to make up for it, but in fact, we at least can talk about the new movie version today. That's what we're going to do with our guest here on The Nose. A little bit later on The Nose and on the Colin McEnroe Show, you will hear about the departure of someone very, very essential. I don't know what you do when someone essential leaves. I don't know. We can't close. Anyway, joining us today is Tanisha Dugan, artistic producer at TheaterWorks. Jacques Lamar is a playwright, director of client services at Buzz Engine. All three of us have had the experience of getting things up on stage, including musicals. And before we start talking about this one, let's hear kind of a little bit from the opening of In the Heights. You'll, I think, first hear the voice of the lead in what's sort of an ensemble show, but he's the lead, Anthony Ramos.
Just another dime a dozen, mom and pop stop and shop. And oh my God, it's gotten chewed on hot. Like my man Cole Porter said, people come through for a few cold waters and the lottery ticket. Just a part of the routine. Everybody's got a job, everybody's got a dream. They gossip as I sip my coffee and smirk. The first stop is people hop to work. What's it? I'm like $1, $2, $1.50, $1.69. I got it. You want a box of condoms? What kind? That's two quarters, two quarter waters. You need a bag for that, the tax is added. Once you get some practice at it, you do rapid mathematics automatically. Selling maxi pass, fuzzy dice with taxi cash. Practically everybody stressed, yes, but they press through the mess. Bounce checks and wonder what's next.
In the Heights, I find my coffee.
All right, so it's on HBO Max and it's in theaters. One of us, at least, went to see it at a theater. That would be Jacques. And maybe for that reason, Jacques, you should get us going. I mean, this, we should just say, first of all, whatever else this is, it's a big musical in the tradition of just really, really big, heavily populated, why have 25 people in a scene when you could have 100 type musicals?
Yeah, you know, I was so glad that I went to see it in the theater, not just for the scope of it, but also for the sense of audience reaction, because it was, you know, one of the very first public screenings of the film, and so you got the people who were really excited and had been waiting for it, and so that added another dimension. But yeah, I mean, it has that kind of MGM musical scope to it. In terms of, you know, it seems like the cast goes on and on and on in these dance routines, you know, particularly this one in a public pool where you're, you know, it's just...
Well, they go 100% MGM there. I mean, they totally take a bite out of Esther Williams in that scene.
And I think that not having spent any time in Washington Heights, I imagine it's not entirely as candy colored as it appears in this. But it was very kind of sweet to see a big musical on the big screen. And to be with other people in a movie theater again, too.
I bet that was actually. Tanisha, what's your overall reaction to seeing it?
Kind of love how you guys are landing this in the sort of MGM sort of traditional old school Hollywood musical zone. I think that's like totally right and actually very satisfying. And thinking of Esther Williams and thinking of, you know, the Oklahomas and even thinking of like, you know, White Christmas, you know what I mean? I think there's just something really fun and throwbacky about this movie, And that feels very Lin-Manuel Miranda, this sort of like throwback to this time of Hollywood movie musicals. I think he's very much, you know, living, you know, I think his work is very much about recalling that time and placing people like him in his neighborhood inside of those projects. So I think it's really satisfying. And I think Candy, you know, Candy Colored feels very appropriate to me as well. And it makes me think, you know, this is in the eye of the beholder, you know, the way in which you have nostalgia and love for the place that you come from is very much about you being a product of there and you seeing it in a different way than people who might just walk through. So I loved it. And I thought, you know, the actors are fantastic. I love, as a person who does produce theater, the grandness of being able to produce something with a cast of hundreds, because that's just like impossible on the kinds of budgets I tend to work with. So it's like really exciting and aspirational to see the streets of Washington Heights filled with as many humans as would actually be on the streets of Washington Heights in real life. So yeah, I thought it was a good time for sure.
I have to say, first of all, I have to confess that I watched it in a state of exhaustion. And so I may be retracting some of the things that I think about it right now. I'm going to see it two or three more times in the very, very immediate future. I'm a very easy audience for this in some ways. I do regard Hamilton as possibly the biggest cultural achievement, American cultural achievement of my lifetime. I can't really think of anything that sort of, you know, that tops it for me. So I start there. I also, just starting in college in the 70s, started to worship Latin music, and I've stayed with it. I was introduced to the music of Eddie Palmieri and people like that while I was still in college, and so I love that. That said, I want to at least ask a few questions about this, because, I mean, I think you're nuts if you don't go see it. I think it's very smart if you're ready to see something in a movie theater to do what Jacques did. I have some questions about it that I want to explore with you guys. And Jacques, the first place I want to start is, you know, in some ways, this movie's in a terrible position in the sense that the two things that it'll be most likely compared to are Hamilton. Well, who needs that kind of pressure, even if you're the creator of Hamilton? And West Side Story, I think, is the other one. And I one of the things that I was thinking last night is that, although obviously that pool scene, people are going to be talking about that pool scene for decades to come. But, you know, a lot of the musical numbers felt sort of frenetic to a fault and rushed. There's a way in which in West Side Story you can kind of see that Jerome Robbins choreography unfold, not at a leisurely pace, but at a pace where your mind and your eyes can kind of really absorb what's happening. And I felt at times as though the camera and the choreography and the cutting were conspiring almost to deprive me of that experience. But then, as I say, I was exhausted, so that could have been the problem. I'd love to hear both of you on that. But Jacques, yeah, maybe you react.
You know, it's interesting because I felt, it's kind of two sort of big things to address in terms of, you know, the legacy of Hamilton and West Side Story versus, you know, In the Heights, which is certainly a lighter piece of entertainment than those two. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what's interesting musically about Hamilton is that he goes in many more different directions, I think, even though it's very rooted in hip hop. I feel like it's grounded in a number of different genres in terms of R&B and pop and musical theater. Whereas I find the musical palette of In the Heights to be a bit more narrow. And I think, you know, where you have that amazing tension between Burr and Hamilton and Jefferson and Hamilton and the women in Hamilton's life. And then West Side Story obviously has the tension that's built into Romeo and Juliet of these warring gangs and star-crossed lovers. The stakes don't feel quite as high in the Heights. And there's no quote unquote, you know, really kind of present bad guy other than gentrification, which is a bad guy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's only personified by a dry cleaner overcharging for napkins. And so, you know, I kind of feel like it's, you have to go in with a sense, you know, I think a lighter sense of entertainment, rather than stacking it up against those two works. Mm-hmm. I think what does, it does have in its favor is that it's so authentically, at least to, you know, my white eyes and ears, Latin. And it's so, I imagine the experience of being Latinx and sitting in the audience and having this wash over you would be an incredibly joyful experience in terms of the music and the cultures cited and the actors. You know, there's very, very few actors who aren't Latinx on that screen. So I think that in that sense, you know, that's hugely important. To get to the, we were just discussing, and I had tried to pull up IMDb's real quick, so I got the director's name correct. I can't remember his name.
It's John Chu.
John Chu.
Guy who directed Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, which I thought, you know, his visual style in Crazy Rich Asians, and in much of this, is fabulous. But that, like, the sequence in the beauty salon was so frenetic that it was almost impossible to enjoy. Like the cutting of it was so fast that you couldn't really reflect on certain performances. There were moments where that worked in its favor when they were at the, like, the late night salsa club. But there are, you know, the moments where it does take its time and allow you to kind of really breathe, like when they're dancing on the side of the building, and that's such a spoiler, I'm sorry, but it was such an elegantly filmed magical moment.
Yeah, Tanisha, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I don't think it's a spoiler to say dancing on the side of the building, because until you see it, you won't quite imagine what Jacques is saying. But I think there's something really interesting that you two bring up, especially about Lin-Manuel as an artist. You know, he is rooted in jazz and hip hop, and those are two genres that are very much about quoting things. And I've said this in previous Nose episodes. I think there's something very millennial about an artist that uses quotations of other works as the sort of building blocks or crayons for their art. We do see that both musically, because that is very much Lin's aesthetic, but I think you see it in the choices that John is making for the movie as well. And I think they are quoting West Side Story. I think they are making some choices to sort of connect themselves to the heritage that connect us to the heritage of past movie musicals. I actually happen to love the beauty salon scene. And I did not have that response of like, oh, this feels too frenetic. I love, spoiler alert, the wig sort of dancing and moving.
Oh, me too.
By themselves.
Oh, that
I
was
thought
great.
That was just, oh, so good.
It was very Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast. Speaking of quoting.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of the casting, you know, I think that casting was brilliant. I think having, you know, drag stars and trans stars and folks that, if you really are paying attention to Latinx Hollywood, you know, Jimmy Smith and Mark Anthony, I think that in addition to being a love song to his neighborhood, this project feels like a love song to Latinx artists writ large.
Mm. Absolutely.
And
yeah,
also, I was so excited to see, like, Maria Hinojosa appear as the, you know, at the Dreamers rally.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't expecting that. And that was such a nice, nice moment. And I think, you know, casting leads that are, you know, just the side of unknowns, or at least unknowns in general, you know, to the general public. And I guess by general public, I mean, you know, white audiences. It was nice to not, you know, to see real, you know, you oftentimes with these movie musicals, they shoehorn in a star who may have questionable singing ability.
Yeah, no, I think that they were pressured on that. First of all, this musical took a long time to make. I mean, it was, I think, first being discussed in 09. So, I mean, the movie version, you know, and then it got into turnaround. They had all kinds of problems. And one of the problems that they had, and this is not any kind of secret, is, you know, the studios, the funders would say, you know, there aren't enough Latinx stars who test well internationally. That's like one of the new phrases. They don't test well internationally. And that's sort of code for nobody's heard of them and nobody's heard of them in the Asian markets, which we really need, blah, 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 blah. You know, and the response in the Latinx community is that's because you never put any people in movies. And so they're and then you complain that nobody knows anybody. Well, that's because you won't use anybody. And I think just, you know, just ultimately the weight of Lin-Manuel Miranda's reputation. And Chu, once he got involved, you know, I mean, he now makes profitable movies. That's very well known. You know, that really helped the thing get made. I mean, a lot of these people, yeah, as you were saying, Tanisha, if you know a little bit about sort of Latin performers, you know that Melissa Barrero plays Vanessa, was in Vida. You know, they aren't big stars. It's hard to get this movie made. I think getting the movie made itself is an incredible triumph. I want to just take a quick break. We're going to come back with more of Jacques and more of Tanisha after this.
$96,000.
Holla!
$96,000.
That's a lot of spray cans.
$96,000.
Yo, if I won the lotto tomorrow, well, I know I wouldn't bother going on no spending spree. I pick a business school and pay the entrance fee. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll stay friends with me. I'll be a businessman richer than Nina's daddy. Tiger Woods and I on the links, and he's my caddy. My money's making money.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davita Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
We're back. We're just going to keep talking about In the Heights. I mean, look, we're all theater nerds here, so. Might as well. I mean, we don't get a chance to talk about stuff like this on the radio all that often, particularly with Tanisha Dugan, artistic producer at TheaterWorks, Jacques Lamar, playwright and director of client services at Buzz Engine. So, you know, Tanisha, there's kind of an interesting double-edged sword that comes up around projects like this one, and that is, what do you do? Do you film the musical or film the play even, you know, or do you significantly adapt it to see if you can, A, exploit some of the advantages you have in making a film, and B, maybe, you know, just make it feel a little bit more relevant. So, you know, with Hamilton, I mean, we know what they did with Hamilton. Here they've gone really in the opposite direction. I mean, there are, you know, numbers that are cut from the original Broadway show. There are plot lines that are added. We've already mentioned there's a Dreamers plot, you know. And I was struggling a little bit. Not that I have a huge allegiance to or knowledge of the Broadway original, but I was sort of thinking, ooh, they had to like jam a Dreamers plot in there, or maybe they had to draw. They really did have to put a Dreamers plot in there. I mean, it's sort of a no win, no lose situation, you know, when you start making these decisions, and it's no lose when you have such a good thing to begin with to work with.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm trying to decide which direction I want to go in first.
Okay.
I think the first direction I'll go in is I'm actually really thrilled with them sort of choosing to go the route of big movie musical, right? And therefore it is a movie, and therefore it is shot on location. And I think what's really, you know, what was so satisfying to me in quoting this kind of old Hollywood movie is that you didn't have to be on a big soundstage, right? Like, this was the anti-soundstage, because a soundstage is trying to make a stage like real life, and they chose to shoot it like real life. And so I loved that. And I think in an attempt to root it in real life, tying in these threads of, you know, dreamers into the piece, which wasn't in the original, I would.
Right. It was not.
Beg to say, right? Feels to me in some ways like Lin-Manuel trying to reckon with some of the mistakes that Hamilton has been kind of slammed for in retrospect, and you know, more politically correct or more sensitive to how to be politically in the conversation. And frankly, I'm in a space where I'm like, that's not Lin-Manuel's thing, and I don't really want it from him, right? Like, he is the candy-coated dreamer, and not to use, you know, not to make the pun, but he is a believer in the American dream, in the American story, in a post-racial understanding of America. And I think it's really good to have artists who create that world for us, right? He is not the one who's going to build the bridge from where we are to the post-racial vision. He's just going to continue to give us that post-racial vision. And so I am very much like you, Colin, in the sense that having sort of the dream subplot was made me roll my eyes, because I sort of was like, while this is true, mm-hmm. for these people living in this place at this time, that's not what this musical is about.
Right.
And this is not your work.
It can feel a little like ticking boxes. Go ahead, Jacques.
Can I be a contrarian?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think when the musical came out versus when the movie was made, I'm assuming the movie was made squarely during the Trump administration, when Dreamers and the Dream Act and what DACA were much more at risk than during when the musical debuted, which is probably during the Obama administration, would be my guess.
We should say 2005. It was actually, the first version was done in Waterford at the O'Neill Center. But yeah, I think 08 is around the time it comes to Broadway.
I didn't remember. There's a lot about the show I didn't remember on stage. And quite frankly, I think the movie is better than the stage show. But it, you know, it struck me. I'm like, what is this about? Because there's no, you know, traditional antagonist or what have you. And it's all about dreams. These are all dreamers who are literally, some of them are dreamers. But, you know, he's dreaming of going back to the Dominican Republic, to what used to be, you know, he keeps saying was the best, you know, days of his life, and fulfilling his father's dream of having this place that was literally called the Little Dream. And Vanessa is dreaming of, you know, being a fashion designer, and Jimmy Smits is, you know, trying to fulfill his dreams for his daughter and whatnot. So, I mean, the movie is literally, you know, the story is literally about dreams and dreamers. Some of those dreams come true, some of those dreams don't. Some of them, you know, like the abuelita coming to the U.S. is dreaming of a certain life, and her mother is dreaming of a certain life for her that she doesn't necessarily get to achieve. So I didn't take that as a difficult thing to swallow.
One name I want to say before we run out of time.
You know, I do want to walk back.
Okay. Walk back.
Sorry,
Tom. Oh, no, I just want to quickly, I just want to shout out, so we don't, I just don't want to be unfair, particularly to a female creator. We haven't said the name Chiara Alegria. She's the person who wrote, I think, the book for the original musical and wrote this screenplay. And so a lot of the choices and decisions that we're talking about are at least, if not more, I mean, she and John Chu found the swimming pool. She took John Chu to the swimming pool, and they were looking at it like, is this anything? Could we put this in or something? But there's a lot of stuff in this movie that is her, maybe even in some cases definitely more than Lin-Manuel. Anyway, what were you going to say, Tanisha?
No, I was just going to say, you know, I think I made an assertion that this wasn't Lin-Manuel's work. And as an artist, I would never want to put someone in a box and say your work is not X, Y, or Z. And so I think Lin is on a journey of how to make his work do some work on us in ways beyond being wildly entertaining and a fun time. So I wanted to walk that back because I know we're all on a journey in this time of like how we tell stories that are impactful, not just, you know, to our heartstrings and our mind strings, but culturally. I just
want
to say that.
Sorry. I like that. Actually, we're going to have to kind of wrap this up here, unfortunately. We're going to be heading into a pledge break here. I do want to thank Tanisha Dugan. I also want to quickly say, I just want to see Lin-Manuel Miranda's third big work here. I'll be fascinated to see it. There's musically so many tropes, like just like a musical notation almost, that connect these two works. I want to see what he does musically with the next thing. And to Tanisha's point, I want to see cerebrally, or in terms of his heartstrings and mind strings, which I love. I want to see what he does with the third big thing. Tanisha Dugan is artistic producer at TheaterWorks. Jacques Lamar is a playwright and director of client services at Buzz Engine. It's the end of our pledge drive. We are going to ask you to support this show and this station. Please do it. Please do it while we're on the air, too. It helps. It's also the end of an era. Oh, boy, is it the end of an era. And you'll hear about that on the other side of the pledge break. But stay with us. You won't want to miss it.
Hi, I am Kat Pastor. I'm the technical director for the Colin McEnroe Show, and I'm here with John Henry Smith from All Things Considered.
Howdy.
Who claims that he is not beloved, but here we are.
I didn't say I'm not beloved. I just haven't done a focus group to confirm or deny that fact. That's all.
All right, we'll get started on that. But it is the end of the fiscal year. We are a listener-supported station, and we are here to ask for your support. You're currently listening to the Colin McEnroe Show. You're listening to The Nose, which is the weekly cultural roundtable that leads you into the weekend. I think it's a great way to end the week and start the weekend. And if you're enjoying it, this takes money to put on. And we are a listener-supported station. So the way that you can pledge your support today is by calling 1-800-584-2788. Or if you don't want to talk on the phone, you can go to WMPR.org/donate.
Hey, and okay, one more thing about the me being beloved thing. My daughter calls me bald-headed weirdo. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I'm beloved at home or not. I'm just saying. Okay, but I digress. Anyway, about you and us, you the listener and we, Connecticut Public Radio, we get it. These pledge drives, it's a diversion from what you're really here for, to hear the news and information that you've come to rely on to give you that firm understanding of the world that we live in, both here in Connecticut and nationally. And we also get that you are being inundated with solicitations to separate you from your money. Kat and I, we're in the same boat. We, you know, if someone's having a birthday on Facebook, hey, you know, donate to this for my birthday. We get robocalls asking us to donate to that. We understand. You get it at the CVS counter when you're checking out. Hey, would you like to donate this to certain causes? I understand that. We totally understand that. With me, I don't know, Kat, I don't want to speak for you, but for me, I mean, I turn most solicitations down except for the ones that are near and dear to my heart. And the fact that you're listening right now tells me that public radio might just be near and dear to your heart. And we're not just pulling that out of the air. I mean, we've had so many people call us and email us and tell us how indispensable they find our in-depth news coverage, along with our thought-provoking programming here on Connecticut Public Radio. Some people have it on all day as they're doing what they do. If this describes you, make sure you do your part to help us keep serving you. You are paying directly for a service that you enjoy and rely on. So you can donate at 1-800-584-2788 or go to WNPR.org/donate.
That's right. 1-800-584-2788 or WMPR.org/donate. And now this is not just like a solicitation where you give money to us and you get nothing back.
Exactly.
Right. Because if you've been following us for a while, you will notice that our growth has been very expansive, especially in the last year, despite there being a pandemic. So I can assure you, and so can John Henry, that your money goes very, very far.
I just got a new producer.
Yes.
Hey, hey, hey.
Yes, he did. Woo-hoo! From my former employer. So I'm very excited for you for that. But not only that, but we also have, thank you gifts to show our thanks to you, the listener, for supporting us. If you want to talk about a double whammy of donating to a good cause.
Are we allowed to say that on the air?
I think so.
Okay.
I think I've said it before, so I'm just going to go with it. If I have to bleep it, I will.
Wait, I see the FCC calling online too.
Wouldn't be the first time they've called for me. So for $15 a month, you can get a stainless steel pet bowl. It's the Connecticut Public Blue, and it says sit, stay, listen. It has the anti-grip. It has the grip bottom so that, you won't get food and water all over the floor. But more importantly, a lot of the proceeds go to medical care and vaccines for pets in need through the Connecticut Humane Society. So when you donate $15 a month for this pet bowl, not only are you keeping great content on the air that's ever expanding, and I know that this place wants to just keep doing more and more and more. So it's kind of like paying for like a subscription service. But also, you're helping pets in need. I mean, if that doesn't cover all bases, I don't know what does. So call 1-800-584-2788, or you can go to WMPR.org/donate, and thank you very much.
Okay, I got to say thanks to Kat Pastor. She's the technical producer of this show, and as usual, is making the whole thing hum and sound good. And I got to say thanks to the producer of this episode, as usual, with a nose. It's Jonathan McPants. And now I got to say thanks to somebody else. And I do not look forward to this because it's going to make it all real. So Betsy Kaplan has been the senior producer and a producer on the show for so long that I really feel like that we – I think most people who work around here would say that she's sort of my alter ego or something. There's just a way in which, I sort of can't even really imagine how I will think and feel about the show without Betsy Kaplan. But I'm going to have to do that, as it turns out. But before I say anything more, we got a bunch of people together just to sort of talk a little bit about what it's been like to work with Betsy Kaplan, who has decided to – she's going to be executive director of QAnon. I don't know if that's been announced yet. No, she's going to do some wonderful things and seek happiness. And you might have heard a little bit about that on the show with her own essay yesterday. But let's begin with the original producer of the show. We've only had, I think, in 12 years, six people have, we've had some production from interns and a little bit of guest production here and there. But I think there's only like six producers of this show ever. The first one was Patrick Scahill. He started it all. And he's a reporter at Connecticut Public Radio now. Let's hear what the founding producer has to say about this producer.
Betsy and I are both uncomfortable with compliments. So I'll frame this instead as a confession. When I switched from being Colin's producer to a reporter, I couldn't have been happier to hand the reins off to Betsy. And I think Betsy knows that. So here's the confession. Years ago, Betsy would tell me she wanted to follow my example. Truth was, I wanted to follow hers. Here was a nurse who changed careers to work in radio, someone who was smart with no ego, who worked hard and got stuff done, and who, by the way, was amazingly good at it. Producing is not easy. You need to create show ideas, book guests, edit sound, and then do that over and over and over and over again. It's probably one of the hardest jobs in public radio, which is why it's no surprise Betsy was perfect for it. Hardworking, patient, and above all else, kind. The perfect fit for a producer. And even though today is Betsy's last day, I'm not surprised that she's, I'm not joking here, producing next Monday's show, even though she's technically done today. Betsy's never done. It's why she's great. Thanks for everything, Betsy.
Right. Betsy Kaplan's last day is today, except she's producing Monday's show, which is a very, very difficult show, too. It took a tremendous amount. It's the most Betsy Kaplan thing ever, is to produce a show after your last day. All right. One of the things that Betsy has done indisputably is foster the work of interns as they've come aboard here. And some of them are working full time with us now. One of them is a producer on Where We Live, Carmen Baskoff.
My relationship with Betsy goes back to when I was first an intern at WNPR, and I actually worked with Betsy to produce one of my first radio shows ever. It was a show about domesticated foxes, and memorably, during one of our interviews, there was like these wild and eerie screeches going on in the background of the interview of like some sort of creature in heat while we were interviewing some of our guests. So that got me started on the wild and wacky world of producing radio talk shows, something that I've been doing ever since. Betsy's been such an amazing mentor and colleague for me ever since I was an intern, and then, you know, as I've been a producer alongside her. Until COVID hit, our desks were really close together, so Betsy was always somebody that I was turning to bounce around show ideas or picking her brain for guest suggestions. And I'm not sure people realize, because she's behind the scenes, but Betsy is an absolute powerhouse, and I really can't imagine Connecticut Public Radio without her. So really going to miss you, Betsy.
Absolutely. All true. All right. Let's hear from a voice maybe somewhat familiar to you, a fellow named John Dankosky. He hosts the Connecticut Mirror's Steady Habits podcast these days. He's the news and special projects editor for Science Friday. In fact, if you're listening live here at from 1 to 2 on Friday, he's going to be coming on very soon. He's hosting a Science Friday today. Let's hear what he has to say.
Betsy came to us as an intern after a successful career as a nurse at a time when a lot of people were leaving their jobs doing anything else to become a nurse. And I'm not sure what that tells you about Betsy. I know that she did it in part because she really loves the mission of public radio, but she also really loves telling stories. She loves learning things every day. And most importantly, she loves and cares about people. She cares about her family and about her friends and about her colleagues. She cares about getting things done right. But I've been thinking, if there was a caring about people Hall of Fame, Betsy Kaplan would have her own wing. And if we had a live broadcast from the opening of that wing, Betsy would probably volunteer to produce the program herself. That's just who she is. Betsy, we love you, and we're so happy for you, and we cannot wait to see what you're going to do next.
She's actually at home listening to this, sobbing like a baby, according to her on Slack. Anyway, I said that thing about interns. You're going to hear another version of that. Ali Oshinsky was an intern with us, and she's now a core member with Report for America, covering the Naugatuck River Valley for Connecticut Public. Here's Ali.
I was an intern back in 2017, and I would come in every Monday and see Betsy at her desk, sort of cursing under her breath, trying to get together the Monday afternoon scramble. And I'd say, "Hey, Betsy." And she'd turn around and say, "Oh, hey, Allie," with this big smile and really happy to see me, and then turn back around and go back to her desk, putting together the scramble. And it really emphasized to me the work ethic and the passion that you find from Connecticut Public producers and reporters in getting together important content, like informing people, getting the right voices. She has always been so committed to that, and a real awesome role model to look up to then and now. We will miss you so much, Betsy. Thank you for all you've done for Connecticut Public, and also for the listeners of this station. They don't know how much work you've done for them, and I really hope they appreciate that. So thank you, Betsy, for making this a better radio station. We will miss you so much. Bye.
All right. These are great, although people are not making fun of her enough. But that's always been my job. Meanwhile, let's hear from Robin Doyen Aitken, the senior producer for Seasoned on Connecticut Public.
Let me start by saying Betsy is the kindest human, a most generous producer. I couldn't count the number of times I interrupted her work to ask a question, and she never seemed annoyed. I considered her an unofficial mentor. She has no idea. Her professional standard is so high that it's difficult for her to take a compliment. A pretty common experience was that after listening to a show she produced, I'd feel compelled to send her a note to let her know that I was affected by the show, that I recognized her fingerprints on it, and that it was the best hour of radio I'd heard that day. Her response was always the same, an immediate pivot to what she calls Colin's magic dust, and a downplaying of her contribution. One producer can always recognize excellence in another. There's no downplaying it. Oh, to be a producer like Betsy. She has her own magic. Don't let her tell you otherwise.
Colin's magic dust? She tells people about my cocaine problem? you think you can trust somebody around here? All right. I'm really looking forward to this one. The very mysterious and fabulous Lydia Brown is managing producer of Vermont Public Radio's of Vermont Edition. She, well, I'll just let her be Lydia, actually.
It was my last day at Connecticut Public, my last day in a newsroom that had become my second home, my last day with people who had become my second family. There was sushi, there was cake, there was laughter, there were tears, and then there was Betsy. Betsy with her hands clasped around a tissue-wrapped gift, a glossy red dish she'd made in pottery class. When she handed it to me, she said, "Whenever you have a difficult day, look at this dish and remember all of the people who care about you." Well, several months later, I found myself in isolation. COVID-19 had reared its ugly head in Vermont, my new home, and I found myself pretty much alone. But every day I would look at that dish. I still look at that dish. And I remember the joy. The joy of working at Connecticut Public in the Connecticut Public newsroom. But in particular, the joy of working with Betsy. Betsy, there's no one else like you. Thank you for your kindness, your intelligence, and your uncanny ability to predict that a dish would help me through a pandemic. I wish you all the best in your next chapter.
Well, that was great. All right, kind of we're rounding back to some of the core people on the show. Kyone Wolf was both a producer here on the show and the technical producer of the show. Now, of course, she hosts Audacious with Kyone Wolf on Connecticut Public Radio. You should be listening to it, and you should listen to this.
I call her Betsy! I've called her Betsy for over 10 years. Back in the newsroom, in the before times, I'd say it every morning when she'd come in, Betsy! And it was not uncommon when it was just us in the newsroom that we would unload on each other, talking about really personal stuff, stuff that we needed honest feedback on. We'd talk about our relationships, we'd talk about love, we'd talk about death, when it was imminent, when it arrived. We talked about struggles in our families, wanting to do better at work, wanting to be paid more, a lot more. As much as Betsy Kaplan's curiosity, compassion, and brilliance contributed to the heart and soul of the Colin McEnroe Show, and oh, it did, she also contributed to the heart and soul of me. I know that as she explores the possibilities of new adventures, and there will be many, many new adventures, she'll rise to the occasion. And as she lifts off as one member in a crowd of fans, I know she'll hear me cheering her on. Betsy! I love you, Bets. Go get them.
All right. Finally, except for me, Jonathan McNichol. We've been together now. Jonathan, Betsy, and I have been kind of the core producers and whatever it is I do of the Colin McEnroe Show now for 5 or 6 years. Did we decide? What did we decide? Anyway, a long time. And so we're a little nuclear family. So let's hear what Jonathan has to say about being torn away from one part of our family.
Betsy Kaplan and I have been the two full-time producers on the Colin McEnroe Show for going on 6 years now. And actually, we've shared a birthday for a number of years longer than that, which is a pretty weird coincidence, if you think about it, or even if you don't, really. But it occurs to me now, as I'm saying this, that I really haven't come to terms with the fact that Betsy's leaving. Betsy, we're all very happy for you. But we're all very sad for ourselves at the same time. We're just plain gonna miss you, is the thing. I'm gonna miss you swearing to yourself when another scramble guest cancels on a Monday morning. I'm gonna miss you religiously calling me pants, even though you don't really get the joke. And let's be honest, none of us really gets the joke. I'm gonna miss you losing your mug on the fire extinguisher when you brush your teeth at work for the third time of the day. I'm going to miss you yelling at Colin when he screws things up, and the way that takes the focus off of whatever thing I've screwed up most recently. It just simply will never be the same here without you, Betsy Kaplan. It just won't.
Absolutely true. So, yeah, we had this internship program for people who were not college students, who were, you know, elsewhere in their lives and career. It produced most of the producers and some of the on-air talent that you hear here now. So, of course, we got rid of it. But while we had it, this woman from Farmington showed up. She'd been on the Board of Education. She'd been a nurse. She seemed pretty normal. And then I started thinking, no, actually, I think she might be crazy. I think she's, and like, I have no use for normal people. There's no place for you working on my show if you're not, you have to be kind of crazy. And I remember one day I said, I think she might be kind of crazy the way we're crazy. And she always like eavesdrops because she's worried people are talking about her. So she came like running down the hall. What are you saying about me? And I said, you're crazy, but in a good way. And that's absolutely true. And then she became indispensable. I mean, really, I can't tell you how many times in the last few weeks I've realized I have this habit of mine. I think of an idea and then immediately my mind goes, so tell Betsy about that. Tell Betsy about that. Tell Betsy Kaplan about that. And then I go, oh, no, no, there's no, I can't. That's not going to happen anymore. And I really don't even know what to do after that. That's how reflexive this has become. But I want to particularly also talk about another thing she has, which is courage. There's a lot of shows that we've done, and they've won a lot of awards, too, that like nobody else would do. You know, one of them involved infanticide, a young woman who had been convicted of infanticide and speaking to her about that. And it's a show a lot of people wouldn't touch. And she does it without flinching. In fact, the Marshall Project, this, you know, justice initiative, they now come to us because they know we'll do certain shows that nobody else will do. And that's because of Betsy Kaplan. She is absolutely 100% fearless in that way. And I think it's because she is a really good person. And when you're a really good person and you have a really clean conscience, you know you can do things. You know your intentions are good enough so that, yes, you could do something that might be a risk, that might, you know, have some consequences to it. So, and she's been my conscience for a really long time, too. And so, yes, Betsy, I have absolutely no idea what to do next. It's going to be an adventure. It's going to be the first one I've been on without you in a really, really long time. I'm not looking forward to it, but I am looking forward to your continued happiness and your time with your family. And thanks for everything. And now I think we are going to go to a pledge break. So now you see how much trouble we're in. You know, we really need help. Betsy Kaplan's going. So you've not to sort of try to raise money off that, but could you please make a pledge anyway?
one 800 584 2788 or WMPR.org. Those are the places you can go to show your support for this station. It's Cat Pastor. I'm back here with John Henry Smith, and you just the nose. So you know it's time for the weekend when the nose is playing, which is one of the things I love about it.
Hey, Kat, do you think when I grow up I'll be as witty and smart as Colin McEnroe?
I hope to be, but I don't think I'll ever reach that point, to be honest with you.
But I'm going to strive. Let's keep striving,
I'll strive for it, but I don't think I just don't think that my mind works that way. Like, you know what I mean?
His mind is lightning fast.
Right, right. It's like always bringing either funny or a unique perspective, and I know that the listeners really enjoy that, right?
Yeah, the man has jokes.
Mm-hmm. In order to keep this content going, we are asking for listener support. It's the end of the fiscal year. More exciting than the end of the regular year. Am I right?
Oh, money, money, money. Yes.
Right. We are not beholden to the man. We are a listener-supported station. So if you want to show your support for Colin McEnroe and a lot of other shows, you can call 1-800-584-2788 or go to WMPR.org/donate.
Hey, and let's go back to that concept of not being beholden to the man. Listen, again, some of you may have heard me say this before, but my previous experience in journalism, and I've been in broadcast journalism for some 20-odd years, mostly with TV stations, and, you know, most of them have been great and haven't interfered. I'm not going to mention any names, but, I mean, there has been the occasion over two decades where someone taps me on the shoulder and says, you're doing a story on such and such? Well, such and such is an advertiser, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should back off, or maybe go a little softer. That's happened. But I'll tell you where it hasn't happened, here at Connecticut Public Radio, because we don't serve the advertisers. We don't rely on the advertisers for our bread and butter. We rely on you. If you enjoy what we do, then you pay for it and we give it to you. And that's the way it works. And we're so appreciative of so many people who have been out there, who have been willing to show their love for what we do by regularly giving out their donations. And let's speak about those donations. We like big ones. Hey, if somebody wants to write us a check for a couple of $1,000 right now, by all means.
Yeah.
All right. But if you don't have that kind of scratch to spare, no worries. $10, $20, $50, $100, or some other combination of dollars, it's all good. If you all pitch in, we can all get this. You can all do your part to keep us going. 1-800-584-2788, WNPR.org/donate. Thanks.